equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon, this is Carl Ettnayer, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. Got a great show coming up for you today with three guests. We'll begin by talking with Morgan Downey. We had a longer conversation with him earlier this year, and we've had him back every month or two to talk about oil prices and supply. Morgan is the author of Oil 101, an excellent compendium reference book and very readable guide to the history of oil and the oil industry. Our second guest will be John Paul Flintoff. He went searching for the meaning in life, and he ended up making his own clothes. He describes his experiences in the book Through the Eye of a Needle. And finally, we'll return to Bart Anderson, who's been on the show several times before. He's an editor emeritus now of the popular news aggregator website EnergyBulletin.net. And he'll talk about why energy scarcity in the next 5 years means that we all need to take lessons from students, meeting most needs within walking distance, living on nearly nothing, owning only the bare necessities, enjoying a wide range of inexpensive cultural events in an environment of ongoing learning, and he would probably add to that making your own clothes like John Paul Flintoff. But we'll begin by talking with Morgan Downey, coming to us live from New York City. Morgan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Carl. Thanks very much.
So we had some big news on Wednesday with Dubai World, this real estate firm in the United Arab Emirates, a member of OPEC, saying that they didn't want to pay almost $60 billion worth of debt. They wanted to stop payments for 6 months. How does that affect the price of oil?
Well, initially, when the headline came out, it was oil fell about $5 a barrel down to 73, but it's since recovered, and we're back up to $76 today. Overall, it's not really expected to have much of an impact on oil prices or oil demand globally. It's more of a credit market concern. You know, it involves more so the borrowing ability of various governments around the world. And the United Arab Emirates is a very unusual country in that it's more of an affiliation of different countries rather than an independent country, although it is an independent country, in that Dubai, as an emirate, is not a major oil producer. They produce a very, very small amount of oil, but its sister emirate, Abu Dhabi, is the main producer of oil in the UAE. And the issue came about that the oil-rich Abu Dhabi said to Dubai, which doesn't really have that much oil production, we're no longer going to guarantee your real estate construction and spending. So a line was drawn in the sand by the oil rich Abu Dhabi that, you know, it wasn't going to support Dubai's excessive spending for much longer. So that was kind of, you know, because the market was very quiet last week, it kind of had a very exaggerated effect on prices. But overall, its effect on oil demand is not so material.
And it doesn't signal an overall weakness in the economies of the oil exporting countries, because
it's more of a credit issue in that if you've obviously heard of Dubai have gone on this massive construction spending over the last 5-10 years, and if they had done a lot of that, they had borrowed a lot of money obviously to do that, $60 or $80 billion to do that, obviously the real estate market has come tumbling down over the last few years, and their debt has been, you know, their ability to repay their debt has been called into question, and everyone expected their oil rich sister Emirates Abu Dhabi to bail them out, but Abu Dhabi saying, you know, they have helped them in the past, but they're drawing a line in that, you know, where they're, how far they're willing to help them in the future. But it so it's kind of more indicative of the internal politics within the UAE rather than oil demand or supply.
Okay, well, almost a year ago, or a year ago, oil prices were plummeting, and they got down in, I believe it was mid-September, to their lowest point last year after being at record highs, around $35 a barrel. Now they're over twice that high. Is it OPEC that's in control of the high price of oil now?
Yes, very much so, very much so. At the end of last year, in the middle of the depths of the credit crisis, OPEC made a decision to cut supply by total supply in the world is 86 million barrels per day, or 85 million barrels per day rather, and they'd made a decision to cut supply by 4 million barrels per day. And although they never actually implemented the four million barrel per day cut, they implemented at a maximum 0.3 million barrels per day, so they actually cut supply by 3 million barrels per day, and that alone was enough to stop inventories of oil or stocks of oil building around the world. Demand had fallen about 2 million barrels per day. OPEC had removed 3 million barrels per day from the market. So they were actually able to kind of get ahead of the fall in demand by removing more supply. And so that action by OPEC in the fourth quarter of last year removed oil from the market and caused this rally up to we're at $76 per day, and we've been stuck in this range over the last couple of months.
And OPEC has a meeting coming up in December in Angola. What do you anticipate happening there?
We don't anticipate any change at this meeting in Angola. So long as prices stay above $70, OPEC have no incentive to increase production. So I think that we're expecting them to increase production only when oil prices get up close to $100 again. And at that point, I think that you will see an increase in OPEC supply. But so between now and the end of the year, we'll probably stay around $75 a barrel. But as we go through the first quarter of next year, I think that we're going to head back up close to $100 a barrel again. And at that point, in the first quarter of next year, you'll see OPEC increase production. That might keep prices below $100 for the first half of the year. And in the second half of 2010, OPEC will have run out of spare capacity, or will have much more reduced spare capacity, and we may actually then head above $100 a barrel at the end of next year, towards the end of next year.
So is this all predicated on an economic recovery continuing?
Yes, which is, oil prices are a key part of that recovery, in that if we have $100 oil or $100 plus oil, that may derail any recovery. The economy in the U.S. is quite fragile at the moment, as is in most of the developed world, in Europe and so on. The only part of the world that's really growing very strongly at the moment is the developing world: China, Brazil, India, and the risk is that, if we head above $100 per barrel too quickly, if OPEC allow that to happen, if they keep the reins on supply very tight, they would derail the recovery. And they obviously don't want to do that, because if we go back into another recession, oil demand will fall, it hurts OPEC again, maybe they have to remove even more oil from the market to try and support prices. So it's in their interest to have $70 plus oil, but it's not in their interest to have $100 plus oil. So they'll try and keep it, I think, within that range until the global economy is back on more firm feet, especially in the U.S. and Europe.
Morgan Downey is the author of Oil 101. You can order that book. You can read his blog called Scarce Whales, because the oil industry arose in the 19th century from a scarcity of whales, as he points out in the first chapter of his book. You can find all that at his website, morgandowney.com. And there's a link to that at our website right now, equaltimeradio.com. Morgan Downey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Carl. Have a good day.
You too. Coming up, we'll be talking with John Paul Flintoff. He's the author of Through the Eye of a Needle. He went searching for meaning in life and ended up making his own clothes. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettenayer, your Monday host. Coming up, we'll be talking with John Paul Flintoff, the author of Through the Eye of a Needle. John Paul, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So this is quite an interesting book, Through the Eye of a Needle. It has a picture of someone who looks like you on the front cover at a treadle-powered sewing machine, sewing on something. And yet the first half of the book is all about Richard Gere, who you met and interviewed, outsourcing your life to an assistant in India, your gig working as a trash collector for an article that you were working on, and all of that. We get through all of that before we get to making your own clothes. What's all that doing in a book about making your own clothes? Or maybe we could flip the question around and say, what's making your own clothes doing in a book about your search for meaning in life?
Well, it's a perfectly good question. I suppose the simple explanation is that I'm a journalist on a big newspaper in the UK, and I get sent to do lots of very interesting stories about all sorts of different things. And as I do those stories, I start to think very seriously about the issues involved in them. And sometimes you notice there's a kind of connection. And I suppose the thing was, at the very beginning of my book, you may remember there's a bit where I'm sent to New York from London to do several stories at once, and one of them is to be measured up for a suit by a robot with lasers, and it's all very exciting and high tech.
Was that part of a story, or were you doing that for your own purposes?
It was actually going to be a story. It was in the middle of the dot-com boom, and everyone thought, wow, technology is absolutely wonderful. And so we all thought, brilliant, get him measured for a suit by lasers. And at the same time, in some mad thing, I was doing a story about people working in sweatshops in New York for very big known brand names, and it just didn't occur to me that the two things were connected. And I think I can excuse that in a way by saying, I'm a journalist, I have to keep different stories in different parts of my head while I'm researching several at once.
And you were jet lagged.
Afterwards, looking back, I thought, blimey, the people who actually made the suit that was measured by robots might also have been working in a sweatshop. So that did start me thinking on that line. But the big thing that really got me worried was, in the course of being a journalist and just looking for a good story, and in a kind of rather amoral way, not desperately caring one way or the other about the story, but wondering whether it will feed the beast this week, I came across Peak Oil in early 2005, and I thought, wow, this is a cracking story, brilliant, absolutely fantastic, no one's written about this. And then I just went into a very dark moment, and I thought, this is actually terrible, and life's going to change dramatically, and why isn't everyone listening to me? And I found it very hard to get people to run stories about this because it just lacked all credibility. Nobody else was saying it, in the mainstream journals anyway. And so once you start looking at that, you start thinking about how everything is going to have to be somewhat more self-sufficient. And over here anyway, in the UK, people are now really getting the point about growing their own food, and lots of people are doing it with enthusiasm. And it's just always nagged at me that clothing is exactly the same subject as food, but nobody sort of gets it, because you grow plants or animals in order either to eat them or to strip them down and turn them into clothes. You either have meat or you have leather, or you have vegetables or plant fiber. They're all exactly the same. So the issues about water shortages and about fertilizers and all the other things that apply to food equally apply to clothing. And I'm jumping around a little bit here, but the point is that I realized there was scope for me to write a book that was quite funny, because it's about a man making clothes, and in our modern world, that's kind of ridiculous and a little bit embarrassing. Okay. So I could write a funny book that would allow me to tell all of these rather serious things about sweatshops and about Peak Oil, and hope to prepare people in a fairly light-hearted way for what might be quite grim. And as a journalist, I've specialized increasingly, for obvious reasons, in green things. And I'm often sent books that are rather demoralizing. They're very apocalyptic, or else they're kind of how-to manuals on how to be green. And people have done them 100 times, and they're done very well, to the extent that they don't go into all that much detail. But I thought I'll write something different, which is a book that's meant to be fun to read. And it's about trying to work out why we should do any of these things. Why should we care about the people that we're doing this for, or indeed the polar bears, who, if they were nearby us, would probably try to eat us.
John Paul Flintoff, the author of Through the Eye of a Needle, is coming to us from London now, is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, and I think that this serves very well as a description of your personal journey from a newspaper reporter just looking for the next story to someone who is trying to be the change that you want to see in the world. Do you want to talk about how Gandhi influenced what you do?
Yeah, I'd love to. I mean, to be perfectly, you mentioned Richard Gere, and I should say that my family background, in a very dim and distant way, so not in a way that affected me when I was growing up, but my family background are Quaker. And so kind of the things that Gandhi did would have some natural appeal, I suppose. And I always loved the film about Gandhi. I thought it was quite cool. I thought, what a brilliant idea to effect revolution without actually shooting anybody. So not just on a sort of ethical basis. I thought, what a clever and ingenious idea. Mm. And the more I looked into Gandhi, the more I realized that kind of, you know, the hunger strikes and things, was the big showbiz of what he did, whereas actually the low-key, ordinary, humdrum, day-to-day stuff was really the revolutionary bit. I love the fact that Gandhi persuaded enough Indians to grow their own fiber, which they could then spin themselves in order to cut out the English cotton industry. So the English could no longer sell back to the Indians their own cotton. And so he basically substantially undermined the reason for England being, the UK being in India, and got home rule, I think, as much as anything, by getting more people to spin, as by, you know, going on hunger strike, which I think most people think is how he did it. And, you know, the Indian flag recognizes this because it's got the spinning wheel in the middle of it. And I love the fact that this very low-key, domestic thing like spinning can be so revolutionary. And it really is a wonderful way of illustrating this idea that anybody can really do stuff. Do something really small and harmless. And, you know, it can be its own reward also, because you're spinning something and you feel really satisfied afterwards. And that can affect change in a really, really big way. So that was a big influence on me. And I tried to kind of reverse it on Gandhi, because now in England we all depend on the Indians to make our clothes, and we don't know what to do. I mean, if oil ran out and there was some sort of big catastrophe, nobody in the UK would have the faintest idea how to make clothes, except for me and a couple of people who've read my book, because I know that we in these islands used to wear clothes made of nettle. You can't grow cotton in England, but if you can grow nettles, which are widely reviled as a beastly weed that just stings you. But if you harvest them the right way and you take the fibers from them and you go for a lesson, as I have done, in how to spin the fibers, and I accept that it takes a very long time to do this, but you can spin the yarn and then you can knit or crochet or weave the yarn, and then you've got some material. And so I will be making clothes when everyone else has gone naked. Rather like, I think, the German army of the First World War. And I loved the fact, when I discovered this, that the history of the victor is always the history that we learn. But actually, if the Germans had won the First World War, we would all now know that they got by using nettle, which is what they did. They had no access to cotton because England controlled 90% of world cotton. So the Germans, in the end, had to wear nettle to go into battle, otherwise they would go naked, which is obviously not good in battle.
So the moral of the story is, if you wear nettle clothing, you lose the war.
Well, that could be a moral. I think that's kind of twisting it a bit. The moral of the story is, if you haven't got access to stuff, you make do with what's under your nose.
Okay.
And that's what the Germans did. And we've got nettles all over the place. I've got an allotment in London where I grow vegetables, and I have some nettles.
And they're one of the first vegetables of the spring. So if you're looking for your greens in the spring, nettles are good to eat as well.
So you take the leaves and then you leave the stalks, and then in the autumn or the fall you harvest the stalks, and that's how you get the fibers off the edge, and then you're off. Mm. Of course, there are other things. We have flax and we have wool, so it's not only down to nettle. But I love the fact that nettle is so vigorous, it grows without any kind of help. Mm. And so we could do that. We can't do cotton here.
We're talking with John Paul Flintoff, author of Through the Eye of a Needle. Now, getting back to Gandhi, he walked around and used his own spinning wheel in public, and you've expressed something here on the show and also in the book, some hesitance about how manly it is to be sewing in public. Mm-hmm. Your equivalent of his spinning wheel is your crochet. Tell us about that.
Well, I don't feel any hesitance on my own part, but I have noticed that other people look slightly askance at me, especially, oddly enough, the people who work in haberdashery shops. So if I go in and I say, can I have a couple of balls of your, you know, blue-faced Leicester wool, they look at me a little bit as if they think they're on candid camera, and I'm about to reveal that it's only a joke and they don't have to worry, it's just for my wife. But that's fine. I don't have a problem with it. I do like the idea of crochet. I learned to knit when I was very little because I had an older sister and she taught me. But I haven't done much knitting in my life. And then only in the last couple of years I learned about crochet. And I love the kind of portability of a very small crochet hook. You can slip it away in your pocket in a way that you can't with a pair of knitting needles. And I've learned how to make yarn out of old carrier bags, you know, plastic shop bags. And so I can use that and make little things to amuse people. And I've done that a bit. But I like the fact that you can sort of get it out on the train. And people sort of look at you a bit. Pretend they're not looking, and then some of them will talk to you. It really opens doors in a way that is only comparable to when I had I have a 6-year-old girl, and when my daughter came along, people would talk to me in a way that didn't happen before I had a daughter. People talk to you if you've got young children, and I have found that people talk to you, oddly enough, if you have a crochet hook
or a puppy, but they don't allow puppies on the train.
That's true. So your crochet hook is much more hygienic. I should say, actually, though, because you did mention it, sartorial advice. I was very conscious throughout this book that I didn't want to end up only being some kind of mad green lunatic who wears really awful clothes, who everybody else would run a mile from. And so I have this incredible yardstick, which is my wife, and she won't let me out of the house if I make things which don't pass the test of looking good enough to be bought from a shop.
I noticed that a good part of your life seems to be trying to avoid being laughed at by your wife.
Well, it's not so much that she laughs, but she's very strict.
Okay.
She's my biggest champion, but she's also my fiercest critic. And if I get something wrong, she will never fail to tell me. And it just spoils the flavor. So I made a pair of jeans, and when she pointed out that they didn't work because they had a very stiff kind of cardboardy drape, which just wasn't right. And I knew that it wasn't right, but it took Harriet to tell me that. And it's exactly like the feeling, you know, if you sit down and watch a comic movie and the person you're sitting next to says, do you really think this is funny? Afterwards, it's so awful to try to want to laugh at it. You can't laugh till the film's finished. You can't do it anymore. So with those jeans, I just couldn't wear them. It just wouldn't have felt right. So it's not that I'm not trying to postpone onto Harriet all the blame for the criticism, but she is a good way of flushing out what I know myself.
Well, I have a piece of sartorial advice to ask you from, and the answer may vary from Vermont to London, but
okay.
People start simple, or at least I need to start simple in things like repairing my own clothes. So here's a Vermont-type clothes repair question. When I repair my clothes, should I try to match the color of the duct tape to the color of the fabric, or should I just put silver duct tape on everything and let it be widely known that, you know, these are repaired clothes?
I think I don't personally use duct tape all that often, but I do make a bit of a virtue of leaving my repairs just noticeable. I like the fact that people can see that I've actually repaired something. So I don't darn my jeans. The jeans that I'm wearing now have got 4 different patches and innumerable areas of darning, and I don't always use matching thread by any means. And I do sometimes notice the people I'm with, just their eyes just flicker around about the sewing, and I think either they disapprove or they think, hey, great, I must go and do some darning. But at least they've noticed.
Today you can go into a store and buy a new T-shirt that looks like it's been through the wash 100 times and the lettering is all half flaked off, and you can buy stonewashed jeans that look like they've been through the wash, or even pre-ripped jeans maybe, I don't know.
I find that so amazing. I mean, I did live in that universe not so long ago, and I thought that was perfectly normal. But recently at my daughter's school, I've seen some very well-groomed mothers coming away from the school after dropping off the children with these incredibly new jeans that have clearly just been slashed with a knife at the knee, and you think, why have they done that? This is crazy. And I want to kind of run after them and say, do you know what? I can teach you how to do this thing. But I know that's not what they really want.
Do you find with your homemade and home repaired clothes that people mistake you for being at the height of the cutting edge of fashion?
It's funny. It is very funny because I don't aim to look like I'm being cool with this, but someone did say to me that they thought my jeans were meant to be really cool. And I really wasn't doing it for that reason. So that made me think twice about this whole kind of being obvious about having torn and faded garments. I thought maybe I'm sending the wrong message. I haven't resolved that one. It's not meant to be cool. I mean, a part of me likes the idea that someone thinks I'm cool, but that's not what I'm doing it for.
Right. Well, you are on the front cover of your book using a treadle-powered sewing machine. What's the thought behind the treadle power?
Well, it's kind of a joke, because I like to be able to tell people that when the oil runs out, I'll still be sewing and no one else will. but it's also, it's just sort of common sense, because I found that, I mean, I didn't have any skills at all at sewing, and I'd never used a sewing machine really much except a tiny bit at school. And I found on eBay I could buy a treadle pad sewing machine that was otherwise going to be sent to landfill. And, you know, if you can save it from being junked, then why not buy it? And it cost me about $5. So, it, you know, it was a totally harmless purchase. And I learned on it how to do everything that I've done. I mean, I've made fitted shirts and jeans and things all with that machine. So I no longer only have it as a joke. It also looks quite nice. It's a wooden table when it's folded away.
So is that
not
your
white plastic thing.
Is that your only sewing machine now?
It is, but I have to go to a friend or relative to get buttonholes done, because I can't. Modern machines have a facility that does you a very quick buttonhole.
Modern machines, I've seen them demonstrated. You can just walk away from them, and they will make very intricate patterns for quilts and such.
They'll probably make an entire outfit for you without you doing it. You probably the whole thing. Mm. But I love the fact I can get up a real kind of First World War German Army rat-a-tat-tat on the treadle when I'm really going fast, and you know, I'm enjoying it.
Hmm.
It's great.
I have to ask you one more question. This book is published by Permanent Publications. Through the Eye of the Needle is your book, John Paul Flintoff. It's published in the UK. It is distributed here in the US by Vermont's own Chelsea Green. But the top of it says it's a true story of a man who went searching for meaning and ended up making his Y fronts. What's a Y front?
Ah, okay. So you don't know what a Y front is.
It doesn't translate across the Atlantic.
Underpants for men.
Okay.
You imagine the bit at the front is an upside down Y.
Okay.
And there's a very simple reason for that. In the hope that I could make a book that would make people smile, I realized that this whole thing, you know, this kind of gender roles business about should men be crocheting and all this stuff. I thought there's a very interesting and lively debate among feminists about whether or not women should sort of reclaim what their mothers and grandmothers used to do, i.e. all this kind of clothes making, or whether they should walk away from it. And so the debate doesn't really include men one way or the other. So I thought, well, how can I make this work for me? What can I do to really sort of claim this as a man's thing too? And I realized that the one garment in the world that I'm aware of that is uniquely for men is the Y-front underpant. And so that's what I decided I had to make. So I had several goes at it as my last chapters describe, and I felt really vindicated in this, because the whole idea of kind of post-apocalyptic peak oil-y sort of underpants situation was illustrated beautifully by the research of a wonderful Norwegian textiles expert who found in a factory some 100-and-some-years-old underpants from the working class of Norway. And you kind of think, where am I going with this? Well, nobody keeps underpants from ages past. Nobody keeps underpants and puts them in a museum. So we didn't. Nobody's really known what our forebears wore in underwear until Anna Moore Sundbo discovered this stuff. And essentially what would happen for ordinary people in Norway would be that the woman would knit a jumper for the man. And after patching it and darning it and so on for many years, eventually the point came when they had to just take the jumper, cut the arms off, turn them through 45 degrees, and that became your underpants. And so there was this incredibly elementary, very make-do, awfully itchy pair of pants. I use pants in the English sense, not the American trouser sense, but underpants. And so I tried making a pair of pants along the same lines, having shrunk one of my woolen sweaters, and it was really horrible and itchy. But I kind of felt like it helped, because I was doing that green hair shirty thing that all green people are meant to do. And then I took them off, and I made myself much more comfortable pairs of underpants with a Y, just so that I could say I did it. I made it. It's suitable for men. We can do this stuff.
Well, 80 years ago, the Vermont version of that, according to Catherine Breer, who was raised on a farm nearby, I interviewed her a couple weeks ago, was to take the muslin feed bags that chicken feed came in, open them up, put them in the sun with water on them that had to be they had to be re-wetted several times a day to bleach out the lettering, and then her mom would make underwear for her family out of those. They were not very comfortable. They were itchy, but they were free.
You just imagine how history might have been different if all of those people who did all those terrible things in the past were not wearing really itchy underpants. If only they had had good, comfortable underpants, they might have done something much more beneficent.
Well, John Paul Flintoff, author of Through the Eye of a Needle, you write in the beginning of having your outsourced life with your assistant in India ordering a pair of underpants for you. You end up making your own underpants. Congratulations on your journey.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for joining us today. Through the Eye of a Needle is a book by John Paul Flintoff. You can find link to more information about that at our website, equaltimeradio.com. Coming up, we'll be talking with Bart Anderson. He edits is the editor emeritus of EnergyBulletin.net, and we'll be talking to him about going beyond making your own clothes and making your own food, preparing for energy scarcity ahead. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettinger. Well, we're jumping around here. We started out in New York City with Morgan Downey talking about oil price and supply, went to London to talk with John Paul Flintoff about the meaning of life and making your own clothes as a response to the need to do things more locally, and we're going to go out to California now to Bart Anderson, editor emeritus of EnergyBulletin.net. Bart, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Carl.
So EnergyBulletin.net is this wonderful aggregator of information about energy supplies and prices and future outlooks, as well as, well, I'll just read a few of the headlines currently on the site. Ordinary fears / extraordinary times, 55 real things to worry about, if you must. A Chicken Bus and Other Lovely Portents of the Future by Gene Logsdon, the Contrary Farmer. Review of William Catton's book, Bottleneck, and an article about the decline of the wage system. What holds everything together at EnergyBulletin.net?
Well, because for a long time this was a volunteer operation, what held it together was what I was interested in, what the other editors were interested in. And early on, we felt ourselves to be somewhat different from the more pure peak oil sites like the Oil Drum, which go into exquisite detail about depletion and so forth. And we were really interested in the broad picture, all the implications. Also at the beginning, a reader wrote in and said, you know, you're depressing me. You know, give me something to hope for. So we really made attempt to find people that were doing things and ideas and so forth. They're not a solution, but they're at least a response to what's coming.
Hmm. And I must say that if there's one website that I go to, you know, if my time is limited and I just want to keep tabs on the pulse of what's happening in the solution side of things and energy availability side of things, and I go to EnergyBulletin.net. There are other websites like TheOilDrum.com that go into agonizing detail, you could say, even about the details of energy availability. But it's nice to get the overview from EnergyBulletin.net. So there's a link to that at our website, EqualTimeRadio.com. I want to thank you for being a part of it all this years and all these years. And now it's been taken over by the Post Carbon Institute.
It is. Several years ago, Julian Darley of Post Carbon approached us and said, "How can we help?" And they had been hosting our computer systems for several years, and then things developed so it really worked out well for them basically to take us over. Because, you know, I'm sure you're involved with volunteer efforts. You realize that at a certain point, volunteers can only go so far. You need a more formal structure. Mm. So I think it's worked out well for both of us.
Well, good. Well, you said that you've been following John Paul Flintoff's work through his appearances in the newspapers in the United Kingdom. Is John Paul Flintoff making his own clothes? Is that the wave of the future, do you think, in a lot of areas?
Well, I love John Paul's work, and I was very surprised and happy to see him on the Times website. So I hope everybody will buy his new book. Is it the wave of the future? You know what? I think the wave of the future is breaking the current cultural paradigm, and he's certainly doing that. And whether it's like realistic at the moment and viable, who knows? But it's just the process of rethinking it, I think, is valuable. I'll give you one example. My sister is really poor and have three kids, And I was very enthusiastic about sewing my own clothes. And she said, why bother? You know, I just go and pick stuff up at the secondhand store, and it's really great, and so forth. And so, you know, in terms of immediately being useful, maybe not. But in the future, I think it will be.
Hmm. Well, local foods have gotten a lot of attention. Local clothes, not so much. We do have a few people working on them. Local energy sources have gotten a lot of attention. What other, as you've been scanning the horizon of solutions to going local, what other things stand out for you? What other areas of local endeavor?
Well, after I left Energy Bulletin, or retired, I became extremely interested in learning foreign languages on my own. And I couldn't understand the connection between that and peak oil at first. But now I think I do, and that is, it's very possible to have a very satisfying and meaningful time by learning, if you're interested, and learning languages on your own. People did this, you know, centuries ago, 60 years ago, and it's possible to do it. It's even more possible than ever before. And so that fanned out to the question of how to learn on your own without the need for the extensive educational bureaucracy. So that's my current obsession.
Hmm. And an older friend of mine who is studying languages says that, you know, he's been really happy to learn that studying languages keeps his brain fresh and helps prevent Alzheimer's. And he says, you know, I don't have to be good at the languages. I just have to study it, and it keeps the blood flowing to the brain or something.
Absolutely. And you know, the funny thing is, John Paul mentioned, I think, as a joke about the hair shirt approach of greens. And my take is just the opposite. And that is that, you know, if it really feels good, it's got to be green. That is, you know, for me, learning language is such an exquisite pleasure. I mean, I've just got more fun out of that than anything. That's right. That's a good thing to do. So, and the same thing with other things that are green and hair shirty. I don't find them to be so. Bicycling, to me, is one of the great pleasures in life. Good food, gardening, all of these things. I live in Palo Alto, which is one of the richest enclaves in the United States. And at the community garden there, you know, you could throw a watering can and you'd hit a millionaire. And they're out there in their gardens, really enjoying themselves. So,
They're not doing it to save money.
No, they're not doing it to save money.
Mm. Well, that was one of the things that we didn't get a chance to talk with John Paul Flintoff about, but he wrote about it in his book, Through the Eye of a Needle, that he did not... he wasn't sure whether he was saving money or not by doing his own clothes. In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. But he thought, you know, I don't have to spend all my time trying to earn money. People say you could write another article in the time that it took you to sew that shirt, and you could sell it for more than a new shirt would cost you off the shelf. And he said, I don't have to spend all my time earning money. I like variety in my life. I like having hobbies. And during this time, I might have been reading a book or watching TV, and I wouldn't have gotten paid for that either.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was going to change the subject and just ask I really value having your perspective, because you spent so many years just scanning the horizon of what's happening in both energy availability and people adapting to shortages of energy. And I'm wondering where you think the especially fragile sectors of our economy or our society, in terms of our ability to adapt to rising energy prices, shortages in the future, are, and where the especially robust sectors are.
Of the economy?
Of the economy or of our society?
Well, I disagree with the number of peak oil people who see oil as having a direct effect. I'm pretty sure it's going to have an economic effect, and that's how we're going to see things. And there's recession, if it may get deeper, and partly as a result of high energy prices. So that's where I really look to the economy. And the other area, of course, is to conflicts with the Middle East and so forth, China becoming more assertive in getting supplies raw materials and energy. Those are the things that I'm really looking for, rather than anything long lines of the gas station or something like that, which could happen, which I don't think are as critical as the economy and political tensions.
Do you see a danger that as the economy continues to tank, as you think that it may, as tensions rise around the world, that there will be enough of a disconnect between those events and what people like you and I think are the root causes in growing shortages of resources, that there won't be much focus on the root causes?
I think you've expressed the important question, like, for the next 10 years or so. Things are going to be happening. Are we going to be able to understand the root causes, or are we going to get hung up on scapegoats, on ethnic tensions, on blaming other people? That's the big question. And that's why it's really important what you're doing, what I did, what other people have been doing, is trying to draw these connections and relationships.
I was at an event recently where population came up as a topic of discussion, and one of the people there said, well, you know, in the 90s there was a very effective and drastic and quick method of population control demonstrated in Africa, where the Hutus and the Tutsis went to war with each other with machetes, and some 700,000 people were killed within a course of a few months. And I'm not sure the connection between that genocide in Rwanda and the population pressures and the resource pressures that were connected with them there, but that's certainly plausible, and that's something that I've hardly ever seen written about in the mainstream media.
Well, boy, population is one big issue, and I mean, there are other examples of population reduction. I mean, that's a particularly gruesome one. Another one is what happened in the post-Soviet Russia, where population rates, growth rates tanked, and they're losing population. Another example is in the advanced economies, where population rates of Italy, England, Germany, and so forth are falling right now. And another example was the one-child policy in China. So it's a complicated issue, and I'm very dissatisfied with the discussions of population, because it gets back to knee-jerk positions, the same ones that were going on, if you remember, in the 60s and 70s, when people took rigid positions and not much advance happened.
We're talking with Bart Anderson. He's the editor emeritus of EnergyBulletin.net, coming to us from Palo Alto, California. Bart, you're a journalist by training, correct?
That's right. I worked in Staten Island on the Staten Island Advance, and in some weeklies here. I taught it in high school, but for most I got a master's degree from Stanford. But for most of my life, working life, I was a technical writer for Hewlett Packard.
And looking at the various media that are out there, including internet-based media like EnergyBulletin.net, where would you advise people like me who are trying to build a more resilient society, where would you advise us to be investing our efforts in what type of media?
Well, the thing that really excites me is local media. That was my love as a young man. Local community newspapers, to me, they were so vibrant. Various studies show, for example, that in communities within urban Chicago, if they had a good community paper, they could be unified as a community. Whereas those that didn't have such a paper, often fell by the wayside. So I think that's really important. And the other interesting thing about that is the technology now makes it so much more possible than it used to be. You don't need to lay out a lot of money for a printing press or for printing costs and distribution. Now you can do it on the web. It's a one fantastic opportunity.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how important is it that the community paper be on paper?
Well, paper is really nice. I love paper, but it is just extraordinarily expensive. And on the web, you can do it for like a fraction of the price. So, you know, that's the trade-off.
And email lists are something that that some people use for fulfilling those functions too. I was at a dinner last night with somebody who mentioned that he's on a, well, there are two email lists. One for the town of Calais, which is near to our Waterbury studios, relatively near, and has general town related and community events. And he's also on a neighborhood watch email list. So it's sort of a do-it-yourself paper.
You know, I was in the Society of Environmental Journalists, and one of the trends that I saw that I didn't like was they equated journalism with daily journalism for daily papers or the big money mass media. But that's not at all true. Not at all true. What you're talking about is just as much journalism as what they're doing, and I would argue more productive, more effective journalism. I found that the higher you got in journalism, the less control you had over what you did. Whereas at the community level, it could be very satisfying.
On the other hand, the higher you get in journalism, the more you have buffers of editors and people ensuring that you've double-checked your facts and you're trained to check your facts. Whereas people who get on blogs and email lists and more informal types of journalism like that don't have that training. Do you see that as being a peril for journalism?
Well, I think one of the key things is whether you get feedback or not. With your journalism, I'm guessing that you get email if you mess up or if people are unhappy. And I think that's a key thing, being able to get feedback. I know when I made a mistake on Energy Bulletin or an unpopular decision, you know, I heard about it.
Right.
So, what's amazing is you make a typo or, you know, an error with the number of zeros, you've got people out there that will tell you. So, I really think the buffer of editors that you're talking about is really overrated. And the reason why is that, you know, it is true that they will detect errors in spelling, but as for total errors in emphasis and understanding, often the editors won't get it because they share those errors. You know, one example is the New York Times and the Washington Post, great papers. They've totally blown it on peak oil, totally. Just about every other big newspaper around has done better. The Financial Times in England, much better. The Guardian, much better. Much fairer coverage, much more accurate coverage, much more complete. The Times and the Post have the resources to do it. They've got the banks of editors, but they're not getting the story.
What parts of the peak oil story do you see them not getting at the New York Times and the Washington Post?
Well, the main energy writer on the New York Times is Jad Moulwad, and every once in a while he will mention it, but he doesn't really get it. I mean, if you're familiar with the peak oil ideas, he's not really familiar. He's getting more familiar with them, but he doesn't really get it. And somebody from the oil jump could and have given point by point rebuttals of some of the arguments that he has in his articles.
He seems to take at face value arguments made by a discredited Cambridge-based consulting firm.
Yeah, exactly. And the oil companies. You know, he pretty much, from what I can see, takes the oil companies' predictions and experts very seriously, without understanding that what he's hearing is the official position, and what the experts are saying between themselves may be very different. The other thing is this is sort of scary. The Washington Post is the main paper read by politicians, national politicians in the United States. Tom Whipple, right? You know, a big peak oil journalist, a former preparer of information reports for the CIA. He said that, and he pointed out that the Washington Post had almost nothing about peak oil in the last several years.
It's a good thing that he's writing in Falls Church, Virginia, for many of the same people, but it's not nearly as wide an audience, I assume.
As the Washington Post, right?
Right. Very good. Well, any final comments? We got about 30 seconds left for you, Bart Anderson.
Well, I think I watch what you're doing, Carl, in Vermont, and some of the neat stuff that's happening in Vermont. So I hope you keep doing that. The other thing is, if somebody's interested in population, I wish somebody would investigate population issues with the same rigor that people have investigated oil issues. That would be a real contribution.
That's a good thought. Okay, well, Bart Anderson, Editor Emeritus of EnergyBulletin.net, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Carl.
So we've taken quite a journey from looking at the price of oil. Morgan Downey, author of Oil 101, thinks it's likely to remain stable for the next several months, climbing up to $100 a barrel by the end of 2010. Talked about making your own clothes. John Paul Flintoff uses peak oil as one of the reasons to gain skills that nobody around him has, including spinning thread out of nettles. And Bart Anderson gives us a journalist perspective on the coverage of peak oil and lambasts New York Times and the Washington Post for their lack of coverage. I'm Carl Etnayer. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. I'll be back next Monday at 1 o'clock. The Equal Time team continues tomorrow with Travin. Anthony Polina is on Wednesday and Thursday. Tom Hartman on Friday with Bernie. Check EqualTimeRadio.com for podcasts of these shows and links. Artie Levine produced the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
Whistleblowers at the International Energy Agency are claiming that U.S. pressure is preventing the agency from being honest in its predictions of future world oil availability. The International Energy Agency, the IEA, was formed in 1974 by the world's industrialized countries. The preceding year's sudden oil price rise and the Arab oil embargo got their attention. The industrialized countries were also the world's oil-dependent countries. They wanted a watchdog to help them foresee and prevent future disruptions in the fuel supply. If the whistleblower's claims are true, the watchdog is being muzzled by the biggest oil importer in the world. In the story published in the British newspaper The Guardian, one of the whistleblowers is quoted as saying, "The IEA in 2005 was predicting oil supplies could rise as high as 120 million barrels a day by 2030, although it was forced to reduce this gradually to 116 and then 105 million last year. That 120 million figure was always nonsense, but even today's number is much higher than can be justified, and the IEA knows this." The source continues, "Many inside the organization believe that maintaining oil supplies at even 90 to 95 million barrels a day would be impossible, but there are fears that panic could spread on the financial markets if the figures were brought down further. And the Americans fear the end of oil supremacy because it would threaten their power over access to oil resources." Unquote. The whistleblower, who The Guardian says still works as a senior official at the IEA, refused to be identified by name. The Guardian quotes another senior IEA official as supporting key parts of what the first official said. The second official has left the agency, but still will only speak out anonymously. The remarks came last month, as the IEA prepared to release its annual World Energy Outlook. The high-profile annual report, now released, does indeed say that 105 million barrels of oil a day in 2030 is a possibility. Apparently, the IEA wants the world to believe that more than a 25% increase in oil production is possible. For the first time, the World Energy Outlook also includes a second scenario, with carbon emissions limited enough to keep CO2 concentrations no higher than 450 parts per million. You might ask where 450 parts per million comes from. Didn't October see thousands of demonstrations worldwide to highlight the message of leading climate scientists, like NASA's James Hansen, that 350 parts per million is a number to shoot for? Hansen and his colleagues fear that the world will not remain habitable for civilizations at 450 ppm. 350 ppm is a number to shoot for if runaway climate change is to be avoided. Apparently, the watchdog agency is failing to bark at two burglars. It won't tell the truth about limitations in the oil supply, and its scenario for responding to climate change is inadequate. Meanwhile, external criticism of the agency is mounting. The latest critique was accepted in November by the journal Energy Policy. It's a publication by Uppsala professor Kjell Alaklet and others, criticizing last year's IEA World Energy Outlook projections for 2030. Those were similar to what the IEA released this week. The Swedish paper says no more than 75 million barrels of oil a day are possible in 2030, down from today's 83 million barrels per day. Alaklet's paper acknowledges a connection between oil use and economic growth and suggests that policymakers, quote, rethink their future plans for economic growth, unquote. You and I can't increase the supply of oil. We're getting a clear message from many experts who don't succumb to pressure from the U.S. government to lie to us. They say little or no increase in oil production is possible, and two decades from now, the world will inevitably produce less oil than it does now. The U.S. relies on oil imports for two-thirds of what we use, so we're especially vulnerable. We can control our demand for oil, and many ways to save oil also save a lot of money in the short term. The importance of investing in efficiency and learning to live more simply just continues to increase. And it pays for itself, even if our government won't tell us the truth. I'm Carl Ettner, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.